Girls are coming out of the woods, wrapped in cloaks and hoods, carrying iron bars and candles and a multitude of scars collected on acres of premature grass and city buses in temples and bars. Girls are coming out of the woods.
This is Writer's Mosaic in Conversation. Vayu Naidu talks to Tashani Doshi about the round-the-world adventures her poetry has taken her on.
Welcome, Tashani. Such a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you, Vayu. Lovely to be here.
Great. All the way from Madras, Chennai, into this. And you've traveled through to Dublin. You're actually doing a tour of your book.
Yeah.
But I'm not going to stick to a kind of a chronology or linearity of time. Your poetry is a real sort of activism of the soul, and it has that substance. And really what I wanted to share with our Writer's Mosaic listeners and readers was that arc that you take. You look at issues on climate change, gender and other identities, and you talk about war, but war with a call to life. And we'll go through your collections and your readings, which would be absolutely splendid for us. I was wondering if you'd take us through your first adventure of this project on the Russian ship with these high school children. So tell us about it. Talk us through it.
So essentially, I was a kind of, you know, poet for hire and only interested in traveling the world in my 20s. And anytime I got the opportunity to do so, I would go. And Antarctica came up as a conversation. Two Canadian friends who run this organization called Students on Ice, who had been taking children, you know, celebrities and rich people to the poles, and then shifted gears and said, "Look, we want to make a difference. So let's take young people, and let's choose the really, you know, top percent of these high school students who are then going to become the future glaciologists and marine biologists and all of this." And so I went along as a kind of babysitter because they're still teenagers, no matter how smart they were, and they needed looking after. And Antarctica
and how many
was...
How days was this for?
It was a two-week trip.
Wow.
And it remains one of the places that I have never been able to write a poem about, and which is strange because I always write about places very important to me. But it was a truly surreal experience, and I was unable to find my holding there, primarily because humans have never lived there as a civilization, and your sense of perspective is completely out, you know. I did write a few articles about that, and one of them happened to get onto the newspaper, the Hindu newspaper in Chennai, and then it got onto the syllabus. And for the last 20 years, I've been bombarded by teachers and students asking me what I meant when I said this or that. And I said, look, that was a long time ago.
But it's a fantastic work. It's a real legacy of understanding the relationship of, in a way, us humans to the history of the earth. I think that was quite incredible when I was reading.
Yeah, absolutely. The sense of connection, the sense of our relationship to time, I think, which really you understand how minuscule the human element of being on this planet has been, and how deep the time goes back in the past. And I think, you know, this was many years ago, but the foreshadowing of the sense of climate change and what does it mean to go through these places, to go through lightly. So yeah, it was an extraordinary experience, and it was educational because I also was sitting in on the classes, and you know, I kind of remember it being this life-changing moment. But at the same time, I feel yeah, I was privileged to go. I don't feel I will go back. But that was the one time, you know?
Yeah, it's a real sort of moment in time in a way. And I, it also, while reading the essay, it sort of brought to me your, in a way, the form in poetry where you are, as a poet, a vehicle acoustically of absorbing and witnessing and take that forward. So I'm sort of going to move to your next collection. By the way, the essay that Tashani wrote was called Journey to the End of the Earth. It's an essay. It's available quite widely online. Very educational. So, you know, it takes you right from, I think, great material for sixth formers. So now I'm going to sort of move us quickly on to your poetry, which is beyond the geographic, and it moves into the frontiers of gender. Now, you're someone long before Me Too came up as a great movement. You were looking now through words and through performance to break away from that silence that many women undergoing violence have been shackled by. And that collection called Girls Are Coming Out of the Woods. It's written for somebody, but it doesn't matter. I think it's got all women. It addresses all women and changing times.
I think, interestingly, when I became a dancer in my mid-20s, and I thought that I understood my body quite well, and I understood that I'd been lugging around this thing without really understanding it, even though I was very athletic. And I think there was a real inward movement for me to understand what it means to navigate the world with this anatomy, with this frame as a woman, with this frame as a woman in this particular country. And when I say that, I mean in India, where you have this strange scale, let's say, of adoration, of worship, of mother, of goddess, of feminine principle, which is very, very primal, the beginning of all life, and where there are the statistics of, you know, female infanticide and feticide, of rapes and of all the, you know, dowry deaths and all of that, as we well know, because it's there in the papers and around us. And I think in my very first collection, I have a poem which is, I think, on the A levels here, called The Deliverer. And that's about a baby that my mother brought to America. And it was from a convent in Kerala. And essentially, the understanding that no boys were ever abandoned, and it was always the girl babies. And there was this examining of behaviors of society, of what does it mean to be in a society which has this kind of construct of patriarchy, but within that, this divine feminine principle of the roadside shrines of, you know,
it's such a paradox.
It's a paradox, yeah. And I think that all of my work has come from that paradox, that sense of this frame of girl, woman being incredibly strong, incredibly powerful, able to sustain an entire universe type of thing. You know, just from this body comes forth the whole planet. And at the same time, being so violated. And I think in Girls Are Coming Out of the Woods, that was the sort of really a couple of things that informed that collection. One was the incident of Jyoti Singh being raped on a bus in Delhi, but it was also a very dear friend of mine who was murdered and raped in her apartment in Goa. Gosh. Monica. And it was this sense of that violence circling close, and you could no longer say, oh, it's so far away, it happened somewhere else. You know, all the excuses that are given, you shouldn't have worn this, you should have stayed in the house, blah, blah, blah. And we know those statistics are, you know, and the reality is that it is often something that is coming from very close to home, And that's what many women go through. So, yeah, I think for me, I'm really interested in what do I do with this? Because writing about violence, you also have the capacity to double the violence. And so you don't want to do that. You don't want it to be just voyeuristic mm-hmm. in that way and lurid and just repeating of, oh, this is what happened. That is what happened. Oh, horrible. But how to harness and how to work within the areas of reclamation and transformation, which is, I think, deeply that language and dance and art can do, is taking this emotion, this feeling, this despair, and converting it into something holdable, bearable, or even something strident. And I think Girls Are Coming Out of the Woods, for me, was this real rage, this channeling of rage, of anger, of hauntedness, of an anthem of girls and women marching out of the woods with weapons and with battle cries and this sense of like, we will not be silenced or vanished, you know. And it just happened in that moment. And then, you know, Me Too came a little later, and it was written out of years of, you know, And I think in a way, it's always going to be one of the topics or one of the issues that I think about, because I feel this is the body I have. This is the society I belong to. And that's how I move through the world, through trying to navigate these dichotomies.
And yes, it's really a sense of the rage, where I found it, in a way, if I can use the word therapeutic, and this is where your art and what you have felt as this vehicle, absorbing, witnessing, that's the aesthetic activism, is this is a wonderful thing, and I can't quote it verbatim, but Jung talks about what is loneliness. It's not about not having anybody around, but for a lot of women, not being able to talk about it, or even feeling that they'd be understood. And you really unleash the tongue, and your performance also, you know, gesturally, yeah, does that. So would you give us the pleasure of reading from it, please?
Okay. Girls are coming out of the woods, wrapped in cloaks and hoods, carrying iron bars and candles and a multitude of scars collected on acres of premature grass and city buses, in temples and bars. Girls are coming out of the woods with panties tied around their lips, making such a noise it's impossible to hear. Is the world speaking too? Is it really asking, what does it mean to give someone a proper resting? Girls are coming out of the woods, lifting their broken legs high, leaking secrets from unfastened thighs, all the lies whispered by strangers and swimming coaches and uncles, especially uncles, who said spreading would be light and easy, who put bullets in their chests and fed their pretty faces to fire, who sucked the mud clean off their ribs and decorated their coffins with briar. Girls are coming out of the woods, clearing the ground to scatter their stories, even those girls found naked in ditches and wells, those forgotten in neglected attics and buried in riverbeds like sediments from a different century. They've crawled their way out from behind the curtains of childhood, the silver pink weight of their bodies pushing against water, against the sad, feathered tarnish of remembrance. Girls are coming out of the woods the way birds arrive at morning windows, pecking and humming, until all you can hear is the smash of their minuscule hearts against glass, the bright desperation of sound, bashing, disappearing. Girls are coming out of the woods. They're coming. They're coming. I haven't read that one in a while.
It's very powerful however you read it. I've heard it when you have performed it. So did the performance come after the poem?
Yeah, absolutely. I never ever thought that I would combine movement and poetry together in that performative way that I have done or experimented with, because my world of dance was quite separate and then the world of writing had been quite separate. And it's only when I stopped dancing with the company and, you know, after 15 years of performing, that I felt this sense of gap of, I had been training and working with the body for so long, and to just abandon it felt like a shame and a waste. And I thought, well, what can I do, you know? And so it really came as an invitation, a small experiment, very small scale. And I created Girls, and, you know, primarily because I knew that the form of a dance, which is very rooted to the ground, where I don't actually even move my feet, that worked with the poem in a textured and in a way that was adding to, you know, I didn't want to just do something.
And if I can add that part of Chandralekha, your sort of mentor,
yes,
a choreographer guide,
yeah,
she was very much a kind of a deconstructionist of traditional forms to come to the essence of things. And when I've watched you perform, it's from that lineage of a certain martial art.
Yes.
Of a southern Indian martial art.
It's Kalaripayattu from Kerala. And I think the geometry of Bharatanatyam very much in Chandralekha's work, and yoga also as a form which I've practiced. And I think, yes, there's certain abstraction, but also this sort of just the unadorned body, not prettified with flowers and jewelry, and, you know, this very, very unadorned body. And that in a slowness also, which was a sort of trademark of Chandralekha's work. But I think, yes, this sense of what is the vehicle then of the body on stage? What is the body capable of doing? And in this case, I was thinking, I am talking about these things which are precisely to do with body. And how can that same body then channel back this rage in a way that creates something very powerful? There's just one lone body on stage in this very martial position, you know? And so it worked for that, and I performed it for years, and I continue to, you know, it hasn't gone out of the repertoire,
exactly.
Let's say.
And that's why I felt, you know, it had that, it's the stillness that in a way, I think, contains and manifests or disseminates the rage. Now, you've toured it sort of worldwide, and I've seen a recording of it as well for an Indian audience, and a mixed Indian audience with men, women, and quite middle class in a way. And that was received with great a sense of awe. And have you done it in the Gulf? I mean, you've been based in Abu Dhabi for some time.
I have performed it everywhere. I've performed it in Australia. I've performed it in, you know, festivals all over the world. And the response is always, I think, It generates a visceral response. The poem generates a visceral response, and the performance too. And that was, I suppose, what I was trying to do, is to not sit with the silencing of this, but to hand it back, you know, to the reader, to the viewer.
No, thank you for that, and thank you for the magnificent reading. It gives a great sense of that. So I'm sort of wanting, I suppose I'm going back in time, and I'm looking at your collection from Everything Begins Elsewhere. Again, a terrific title.
That's, I have to say, from John Burnside, who is a poet I love very much. And I was very sad when he passed away recently, but it's from a line of one of his books.
I love the sense of elsewhere. It's sort of origins, it's scattered, and it's I was very struck by this the poem, which I keep calling the Welsh poem, but it's not. It's a memory of Wales,
yeah,
which is one of your landscapes of origin, I should say. So would you both read and tell us about the poem?
So this poem came in rare form, almost the way it exists on the page now, very little editing. I wanted to write about this feeling of returning to my mother's village in North Wales, a village of Nirkwis, which is a one street village in North Wales. And there is a playground, and it's still there, where it was just magical for me as a child to be in this playground, because again, the sense of time completely collapsed, because summer skies, you know, I remember my parents coming and saying, where have you been? It's, you know, 9 o'clock. And it was like not a 9 o'clock sky, you know, which, as you know, in Madras, it's sort of black, dark, pitch black by then. And this was still light. And I thought, we can just keep playing in this endlessness, you know. And in that dissolving of time, I thought how strange it would be and how possible for me to meet my mother as a young girl and for us to play in this playground. And wouldn't it be possible in a place like this? And so the poem is a sestina, which really works on the repetition of these six end words. And, you know, I was thinking about how memory works. And particularly for me, the most potent season is summer. Summer is this endlessness from school. You have these months off. And, you know, for us, it was also the time that we would go to Wales, not every year, once every 3 years or something.
And for me, it was mango season.
Yeah. and this kind of time stacking up one on top of the other, so that this kind of change of age can happen and we could meet, you know. I'll just read the beginning of that poem. It's called Memory of Wales. And the N words are memory, light, playground, this, eight, and mother. This is how it arrives. The memory of Wales on a day of scanty light. I'm walking towards the playground. I will never know newness like this or fear. I'm walking and I'm eight. I see a girl on the swing, my mother, or at least a version of my mother, fair-haired, small. In the memory of Wales, it is often cold. I'm eight, and the cows are stalking light like monsters in the playground. I will never know newness like this. I will never know a world like this. This is my childhood and my mother's. Everything begins in the playground. Beauty, decay, love, lilies. Memory starts here on the stairs, in skylight. Cows chew eternally. I'm eight in this memory. I'm always eight. And it goes
on, yeah. So it's like the eternal dream in a way. It's got that lovely dream quality.
Yeah, and it kind of, the poem shifts, and towards the end, you know, in the envoy, there's this sense of the mother character has met a man and she's going away. I'm eight, but I've always known she'll leave all this. Forsaking, after all, is a kind of memory. My mother is eight and in Wales again. She's in the playground of memory, swinging towards light, towards this. So really, I think time has been my big preoccupation. And I, you know, as a dancer, you're thinking about the space and the time within a particular context of the stage. And in the poem, you have so much more freedom, so much more imagination to construct this kind of, it's almost a small movie, you know,
exactly.
of that collapsing of mother and daughter meeting in the playground, and then mother becoming a child again, mother going off. And the sestina is a great form for this kind of thing, because it keeps bringing you back to those words.
Yes, you know? That's what I love. And there's a musicality, because it's like also time and the beat, or the, you know, the ticking of the Shiva, as I think of it, as yeah. Particles.
Yeah.
And you've really, so it, and it's also that fluidity of what is mother and daughter, you know? We are ourselves both,
yes,
isn't it?
Yeah, exactly, you know, exactly. And this whole turning away from becoming, it's a very nesting idea of, you know, kind of which shifts in your lifetime. But I think when I wrote this poem, it really crystallized and organized certain things for me in this head, and it really pinned to that place this, I attributed this magic. And every time I go back to Nerquist, I go to that playground and I'm there, and those cows are still there in the fields, and so many of the people are long gone, you know, my grandparents and aunts and uncles and all of this, like the feeling is you're so far away from it. But that playground suddenly takes you back into childhood. You just stumble into it.
It's a real Welsh eternity in one sense. But it's how you capture that. And it's the sense of mothers also becoming our children in a way.
Yeah.
But I love the way it takes one out of the selves, mm-hmm, of yourself and your mother. And that's the eternal thing with the cows also, chewing the grass.
The witnessing, watching.
it's fabulous. And the maternity of cows. Mm. It's very interesting, isn't it? In a English, I shouldn't say English, in a Western sense, a cow is, it's quite pejorative. Whereas I think for us as Indians, it's, in a way, there's a comfort, but there's a reverence to it.
Yes, it's of course.
So, I love that little touch you give it.
Yeah.
So beautiful. Thank you. And it's also, you're looking at these identities. I mean, yes, on the surface of it is the Welshness, that moment. It's part of your history. But then I was fascinated by this poem is in that collection, isn't it? The Adulterous Citizen.
Mm.
Love the title again. So tell us about it and read a bit from it.
Sure. So again, a borrowed title from Suketu Mehta's Maximum City, which is about Bombay. And he writes, "I am an adulterous resident. When I am in one city, I am dreaming of the other. I am an exile, citizen of the country of longing. I spent so much of my life being in between places and suffering from that, having this deep longing, mainly my longing for India, I must say. When I left home to go to study in America, I was away in college and then working. So there was a period of about 8 years when I was away, and I was longing always for something of going back. And I think, you know, this idea of walking down the streets of Bombay and craving something in New York, there is something very, very appealing, but it can also go into a disorder in a way, you know. And I started to think about what this idea of elsewhereness means. What does it mean to then be in a place, to inhabit it completely without wanting to be anywhere else? And actually, the only place that I've ever succeeded, I'll say, in feeling that I don't want to be anywhere but here is where I live now, by the sea. When I'm there, I don't want to be anywhere else. So in a way, that's a great gratification and a great homecoming, you know. And I think this poem, I was beginning to start and nudge towards this sense of, can't you just be in the place, you know? I'll read a bit of it. When it comes to it, there's only the long paved road that leads to a house with a burning light, a house you can never own, but allows you to sleep in its bed without demanding sex, eat from its cupboards without paying, lie in the granite cool of its tub without drowning. And only when the first shards of day slice through the blinds of the basement windows, nudging you with something of a whisper, something like maybe it's time to go, do you finally drag your suitcases up the carpeted stairs, out the front door, on to the summer pavements. It is nothing like losing a lover or leaving behind the lanes of childhood. Nothing like scaling the winged walls of memory to discover your friends have packed up their boxes and vanished. More like stumbling into a scene from the future where the ghost of a husband beckons with pictures of a family you no longer recognize and other people's children race across the grass, lulling you into belief that you can always return like this without key in hand to lie in the folds of one city while listening to the jagged, carnal breaths of another.
It's the real final sighing place. And it's not as though you don't travel and you continue to live out of suitcases as well, but it's that you found your place.
Yeah. I read the whole thing because I realized I can't extract from it. But
I'm glad you did.
But yeah, I think that that sense of, when I read this poem now, and again, it's been a long time, it's an old poem. When I read that, I read it now as a longing for wanting to have a place, you know, and I didn't for so long. For so long, I was this itinerant, you know, wandering person / poet / dancer looking for my place in the world. And I really think so much of the endeavor as a poet for me has been the relationship to self and the world. And how do you make your space in the world? And where is it going to be? And how do you negotiate that? And it's always changing. But for me, I know that home, return, Madras, this cycle of leaving and coming back, the return is a very potent, you know, and I begin my novel, Small Days and Nights, with the return to Madras. And even the first one, The Pleasure Seekers, is all about the comings and the goings. And I think for me, that is the most potent feeling, the return home.
It really is. And also it's interesting, it's the coast. You know, I have to say I share this immensely.
We do.
With you because, and I think good old Wolf, you know, when she was talking, it is a room of one's own. But with us, it's really that earth, the salt air, the dogs, the coast.
Yeah.
You know, and I can see, the paradox of always being the itinerant, but the return is always the anchor.
Yeah. And this sense of suddenly being still, suddenly arriving and staying and not be the removing some of the restlessness, let's say. And restlessness is wonderful and it creates wonderful energy and magic. And if without restlessness, we would be stagnant. But I think this was an early attempt to try and say, look, you can't constantly be in this state where you are longing. You just need to find the place where you belong and be there and see then how it goes.
Because I think too much longing just breaks. Oh, I think that's something.
Yeah, a little bit of that longing is very sweet, I think. And it's a wonderful feeling, you know, like even in Madras, I will of course long to be away from Madras. I will long to be walking down the streets of London and, you know, all kinds of things, sitting in a park, things that you can't do here, you do there. But I think the sense of finding a place and that being your place has also been a big project for me.
You absolutely, you know, nail it by saying it's the return. You know, that's crucial because that holds so much of going out but always knowing like a wave you're back in center.
Yeah, that's lovely.
Thank you for that. Tsunami, you were also on the coast when it happened, and I remember I had such vivid memories of it as well, and you've placed it in this poem Homecoming. Is it possible to read or tell us from it? And
sure. So this is from the first collection, Countries of the Body. And I was actually in Madras at my parents' house, and we lived quite close to the sea in Besanagar. And there was some neighbor who called and said, fishermen have said that the sea has come to the land. And it was Boxing Day, We went in our pajamas and nighties to the Besenaga beach to see what had happened, and everything looked fine. And actually, I have two poems about this. One is called The Day We Went to the Sea. Both are in this collection. In the first one, there was an image of a woman holding her sari, and she was looking at the horizon. And I'll never forget it. It just formed such a strong impact. It was as though she was holding up this whole thing, this whole event. And the unbelievability of what had happened. And then, of course, the next days of the news of the endlessness of this list of the many places and people who had been affected by the tsunami. But I think Madras itself is a place that is very defined by its relationship to water. So the tsunami is one of many. We have also had cyclones, we have floods, we have almost reached day zero. We are constantly in danger of overflooding or drought. And I think that that relationship to water, again, because now I live on the sea, on a beach, with the sea in view all the time, that you're very aware of this sense of fragility of living in this kind of an environment. But homecoming is a combination, I suppose. It's let me see if I remember the poem. It's been a while. I forgot how Madras loves noise, loves neighbors and pregnant women and gods and babies and Brahmins who rise like fire hymns to sear the air with habitual earthquakes, how funeral processions clatter down streets with drums and rose petals, dancing death into deafness, how even color can never be quiet, how fisherwomen in screaming red with skirts and incandescent third eyes and bangles like rasping planets, and Tamil women on their morning walks in saris and jasmine and trainers can shred the day and all its skinny silences. I forgot how a man lying under the body of a tattered boat could ask for promises, how they could be as silent as the sea on a wounded day, altering the ground of the earth as simply as the sun filtering through the monsoon rain, dividing everything. So that poem is, yeah, that last bit is, I think, to do with the relationship to the silence of that time.
Yes.
And I'm always struck by talking about the return in Madras of the level of noise. It's quite at a level, you know, the vegetable guy, the bells, there's a lot of noise. And that moment on the beach when we went, it felt so hushed and quiet. And it was this thing of, can't believe what happened, you know, that intake of breath. And I think that was the sense of this strangest of homecomings where everything is silent, you know. So, yeah.
It's very interesting, you know, you really pinned that, because for me, I really started feeling I belonged to Chennai after that tsunami, because we walked up towards the sea edge and you could see the steeples of the shore temples. The water had dragged straight back.
Yeah.
Lot of women casualties because their hair got caught in the splinters.
Yeah.
And, you know, much as we say, oh, there's no education among the fishermen. I remember this a boy who tends goats, and he said, in Tamil, the word they use is the sea has boiled over.
Yeah.
That sort of foam that comes in and boiled over. And we saw these waves, pongi perchi. And then this boy sort of relating this incident of, I was taking the goats out and then suddenly I saw this, and it reminded me of the street storytelling theater that comes into the village. And they told a story about one of these old sages who went down into the sea when the great ocean came. So, you know, it was this wonderful, it's so much vibrance that happens, but it's that silence, and suddenly everyone, the fishermen started having this talk about betrayal.
Mm.
The sea has betrayed me. She never warned.
Mm.
And it's very interesting to just share that sense of belonging and this coast, which is normally we consider, oh, you've got the sea's edge, but it's very grounding.
It also, you know, recalls, if you're thinking of Tamil Sangam poetry, the thousand-year-old poetry, gatherings that went on for hundreds of years, that two of them, I think, were destroyed by a big wave. And so, you know, it's there in the epic, in the mythology, in the long past, again, this memory of the sea swallowing up a kingdom, swallowing up the place. And I think that is something that in a place like India, where you are living again with many, many layers of time, when something like this happens, you also reach for myth, for story. Mm. Because they have spoken about these things.
And it's great to be in this moment to actually,
yes,
in our bodies, to experience it.
Yeah.
So thank you for that well-recovered memory of homecoming in Chennai from a place that you returned to.
Yeah.
So now you seem to know more than anybody else flight and return and migration patterns. And your wonderful new work that came out in May, Egrets, Wild War.
Mm-hmm.
Talk us through it. Read from it, please. I saw your performance both in Dublin and in London at the Jaipur Literature Festival. And now you've added another dimension of media to your work as a solo performer. So take us through it.
Yeah. So this collection really is, you know, a post-COVID collection, I would say, coming out of the fog of this pandemic, which in all its horrors was also very potent and a time of togetherness in the world, of we are going through this together. And then the shock of coming out from that into several wars, conflicts, genocides, and a feeling of constant threat and not togetherness. and there are a lot of birds in the collection. They began with observing, you know, birds in my garden, kingfisher, oriole, peacocks, crows, lots and lots of birds. Bulbuls, parakeets. And then I started to egrets. In fact, the title poem is from watching the egrets do their strange stalking dance, which is like a little dinosaur move, you know, in the garden. And then I started to think of the disappeared birds like the dodo. I have literary birds from the Ramayana. I reference the ancient mariner and the albatross. There are lots of birds in here, birds from the Upanishads. And, you know, once I caught on to the idea of the birds as being these prophecies, these witnesses, these sort of winged messengers that connect the sky and the earth, they're just there as I think, because there's a comma in the title. So the egrets for me represent all of the birds, all of these sort of flying beauties and the epiphanies, and then the comma and the wild war, which is a kind of an ongoingness which is beating us down. And so it's really, again, trying to hold two things that seem quite opposite.
Yeah, and the war is both what we're actually facing with our human bestial tendencies, but it's somehow the birds. I just always have this image of your birds flying like drones time and witnessing all this chaos we constantly cause. You know, they're great seers, aren't they?
Yeah, and they're absolutely, once you start to become the crazy bird lady, you know, there's no going back. So I'm now the crazy dog lady and the crazy bird lady.
Wow, okay.
But I, you know, and there's just something there, the fact that they almost come out of time for me, the sense of, you know, again, this reminder that humans, we have only been here for such a short time and we have created such chaos. And there are also, I think this is a return to me to love poems in this book after two collections of being maybe more looking outward at particular events and responding to news headlines and things like that. And these are sort of more old school lyric love poems of a different body, you know, a body that's going through a different middle age part of life, you know. And so I have poems about perimenopausal desire and things like that. But also I'll read just the first poem, which is called Amor Mundi, and it's love poem for the world, essentially. And yeah, here it goes. Amor Mundi. For years, I throw myself at a rock and say, catch. I'd see a hole and try to shapeshift into it. I won't lie. There were gardens I briefly reveled in until I saw the train tracks and estuaries at the edge of which I almost began a civilization. Something always pulled me back. Meeting you in that winged, lonely century was like moving to a border town and understanding the fallacy of a wall. Evening does not always have to mean defeat. Night cedes to dew and dew to heat. Darling, I do not know how it happened that we found a world to name and love, how this many-drawered cocoon of longing grew, but I want to tell you. The tree outside our window has erupted with bright orange goblets from which a pair of parakeets, emerald-bodied luminaries, feed and feed. So I wanted that sense of lushness, of love, of joyfulness, of celebration, because we are living in a time where there feels, you know, we are watching live stream genocides and wars on our phones, and we are making our coffee and getting on with our day and trying to understand what it means to be human living in this moment. So there is a real pressing down upon that sense of what it means to be human. And I think for me, writing these poems about war, and there are a lot of them in this collection, there was also the equal need to write simply the love poems, the poems which have birds, the poems for the world, about the celebration of the body of being alive, of love in all its forms, because that is what keeps us
human
going, believing in the idea of beauty and wonder and awe.
Such a beautiful note to close our conversation on is, I remember through these the poems that you were reading, it's about actually urging your reader, your listener, to scream, to understand the breath of life, you know.
Yeah.
And it's just so evocative. It's, yes, it is a love poem to the world as well.
Yeah.
So I really thank you, Tishani,
thanks,
for this time and this, you know, you sort of developed an arc of narrative right from your days of taking out school kids to, an oblique
to
white
the South Pole.
So I really thank you for this time, and you certainly have traveled across oceans and continents. And I know you're touring as well.
Yeah.
And wish you good luck with that. So thank you once again.
Thank
from
you.
Writer's Music.
Thank you.
Tishani Doshi was in conversation with Vayu Naidu. To hear more writers, go go to writersmosaic.org.uk.